And just like Catherine, I'm going to be focused down here very, very close to the star. All this stuff happening way out there, we're not going to care about it. We're just going to assume somehow or another it's going to get material down in to the magnetic field, to the star, and somehow or another it's going to load onto that field and eventually make it to the star. But we can talk about that in some more detail. And also just pointing out a couple of things in here. So as Catherine mentioned, there is, we believe, this accretion shock on the stellar surface. She talked a little bit about this. She alluded to the Calvet and Goldbring 98 calculations, which were some of the first to sort of do this in detail. And what you're seeing here in the dashed line is the post-shock temperature when this material hits basically at free fall, stops in a strong shock, and gets up to temperatures of 1.5–2 million degrees. And so it can start emitting in X-rays there. And then also heat up some of this pre-shock material. And you get, as was pointed out, a final spectrum that has a stellar photosphere buried down in here somewhere, and then these extra components due to this heated post-shock and pre-shock and heated photospheric emission that diagnoses the accretion itself. And it's my opinion, there are many different ways to measure accretion onto young stars. I think seeing this short wavelength excess emission in a spectrally resolved, low resolution spectra, but in a spectrally resolved this way is really the best way to measure the accretion rate onto the stars. And that has been done for a number of stars by a number of authors. Here's one back in 1993, Valenti, Bosri, and Johns. And what you get out of these, so these the analysis here, again, you're seeing the observed spectra, the stellar photosphere down here, and then the accretion shock emission in the dashed line, and the photosphere and that accretion shock emission add up to give you the observed spectrum. But what this is really giving you is some way to measure the properties of this shock, accretion shock emission, in order to get a measure of the accretion luminosity. And then you use a formula like this to translate it into an accretion rate. So the measurements are really giving you straightforward the luminosity. And to get the accretion rate, you do have to know the mass and the radius and something about where the inner radius, the truncation radius of the disk, basically where the material loads onto the field and starts falling onto the star. Now, that's not the only thing that diagnoses these accretion flows. There are a host of emission lines. You saw them at low resolution in the previous couple of slides, but if you look at them in high resolution, the ones that are most studied are H-alpha and H-beta probably. You can get out into the Paschen lines. You have the sodium lines. Becoming more and more popular these days is to analyze the helium 10-8-30 line. But a few of these lines, in particular the helium 5876 line and the calcium infrared triplet, this is one of the infrared triplet lines, have, in the case of helium, are dominated by this very bright narrow component. And calcium, you often see both a broad component and this narrow component. And it is believed that this narrow component is forming right at the base of the accretion shock. So effectively forming on the photosphere. So in some sense, tracing the foot points of these accreting regions on the star. Now, one of the things to emphasize is there's a whole host of line shapes that you get when you observe these T Tauri stars. Here is just showing a sample of some of the different H-alpha lines you see from the first panel of the figure in this paper by Sylvie Alencar and Gabor Bosri. Again, you see this helium line with this narrow component. Sometimes you do see a broad component with a little narrow component on top of it. Again, the calcium lines, sometimes the broad component can overwhelm the narrow component. But you see quite a variety of line shapes. There was a question about winds. So in the H-alpha line, you do see some components forming in a wind. But you also see contributions to the line from the accretion flow. And in particular, there are now models of the line profile forming in these accretion flows. The temperature is added by fiat. The temperature has to be in the neighborhood of 8 to 10,000 degrees. 6,000 degrees, I think, is the coolest to reproduce the line profiles that we see. We don't have a really good theory for how the bulk of this magnetosphere is heated. James Muserol and Lee and collaborators were some of the first to calculate in this infalling dipolar-like geometry. And so you see for BP tau, calculated line profiles on the left for these magnetospheric accretion flows. Sorry, observed line profiles on the left, calculated line profiles on the right, and they can reproduce many of the general features. Lee pointed out some of these redshifted or inverse P Cygni components, so that's where we can diagnose some of the velocities of these inflows. And there's been other calculations done by the group from Romanova. This is one of the her collaborators, Kurosawa, who calculated line profiles in some of those actual simulations that were shown a little while ago. And we'll come back to that some more. So there was discussion about should the material really flow onto these field lines and be directed by the field lines or not. And so one of the observations that has now been reproduced by many people is, again, we think that the helium, the narrow component of the helium line, for example, is forming right at the base of that shock. And so you can look at that line in circularly polarized light. Here is the helium 5876 line for BP tau. These are some other lines in the same spectral order. So this is all using a high resolution Echelle spectrograph, observing right and left circularly polarized light. And what you see is the narrow component of the helium line, the narrow component of the calcium line, the infrared triplet lines, they are circularly polarized. And that shows up here as a wavelength shift between the right and left circularly polarized light observed in the two colors. And from that wavelength shift, you can infer a field strength. So in this case, on BP tau, it's 2.4 kilogauss right in the region where the material is accreting. And all of the accreting Titori stars that anybody has looked at that show this narrow component show this type of polarization. So this is a ubiquitous feature of these young stars. And if you look at them over the course of a few days, you often see the polarization in this helium line vary on a time scale that is commensurate with the rotation period. So it looks like you have an isolated spot or region on the star that is accreting and being modulated. The polarization, at least, is being modulated as it rotates around. That doesn't necessarily mean that the field geometry at the surface is a dipole or a pure dipole, but the dipolar component falls off least rapidly with distance as you move away from the star. So out at some distance in the disk, the star is primarily seeing a dipole component. However, that material loads onto those field lines, it can then be directed down to the star. But if you have a more complicated field geometry, if you can trace, you know, the black lines here, the red lines show you what would happen where the dipole would land for different multipolar components. You can have some of those field lines traced back to higher regions on the star. In some cases, they trace back to lower regions on the star. So the complicated field geometry at the stellar surface can influence exactly where these accretion spots occur and exactly what the field strength you measure in the accretion spots are. But almost certainly the disk is primarily interacting with the dipole component of the field. And now you can even do, people have done some magnetic mapping using the technique of Zeeman Doppler imaging. So this is a paper by Donati and collaborators in 2008, where they have looked both at the helium, that helium polarization that I mentioned, but also the photospheric polarization from the absorption lines that are forming over the photosphere of the star. And they can try and reproduce or map out the magnetic geometry because these stars are rotating not too fast. The V sine I is not very high. They're really most sensitive to only the highest order field components, not the really complicated high order components. But they get a geometry. They try to do an extrapolation of the field, and they can measure then or predict where the closed fields are on the star, where the open fields are on the star. And if you, and from the helium line, they can sort of begin to map out where you see the accreting material land on the star. In this case, close to the pole. This is a flattened polar projection, so very near the pole, but not right on the pole. And the Romanova group has taken these types of maps and tried to simulate where the accretion flows would land. And this is shown, this is where the accretion flow is primarily landing. And they get something very similar to what you see in the observation. So there's a nice coherent story that we're beginning to develop. And while I think there's a lot of truth to it, I also want to throw a little bit of cold water on it all. And I'm going to do that by using binaries, eccentric binaries. At least one in particular. There's a few that have been observed. So this is dq tau. There have been there's a number of simulations starting with Artemowitz and Lubow. This is a more recent one by Munoz and Lai, where they are showing what happens, trying to simulate what happens if you have a nearly equal mass binary in a fairly eccentric orbit surrounded by a circumbinary disk. And they find that you excite these accretion streams that come in and tend to meet the star when they're closest to each other, and then the accretion rate goes down when they're further apart. And this is based on the study of dq tau. A lot of people have studied it. Here are the two stars. The dashed lines are meant to represent the sort of canonical truncation radius, truncation distance, the five or so stellar radii based on magnetic field studies. We do certainly see that as the accretion rate, as diagnosed by the U-band luminosity, does appear to go up as they get closer to each other. The point is they get so close that there's almost no way that you can have circumstellar disks. You can have a circumbinary disk, but having circumstellar disks control the accretion almost certainly can't be happening here. So the question is, if you didn't know dq tau was a binary and you just looked at things like its H-alpha profiles, could you tell the difference? And the answer is probably not. The shape of dq tau's H-alpha profile is one of the multitudes of shapes that you see from T Tauri stars. There's not a clear smoking gun there. Now there are things that happen that you can, that allow you to see the difference. So for example, this is a spectroscopic study of dq tau at different times. So the lithium line here is a photospheric absorption line. You can see when they are at close approach, they separate. You can see the two stars because you have a relatively high velocity separation. The helium line, which is tracing the foot points of those accretion flows, also separates. So you can see that there is accretion happening onto both stars. When you look at the H-alpha line, you often see actually a signature of a wind appearing during closest approach, not being so clear when they're far apart. So there are things that are correlated with the orbit in this case, but it's not what I would consider a smoking gun. You have to kind of be looking at, particularly for things like the Balmer lines, these broad, what we often think of as these magnetospheric inflow lines. They look very similar. I also just want to emphasize that variability is a hallmark of these objects, particularly in lines like the H alpha line. So this is a movie showing the H alpha line of SU Auriga. It's a little bit more massive T Tauri star, but it is accreting. We do actually see evidence for rotationally modulated outflow. this is a periodogram shown in period on this axis in the H alpha line, and showing up very strongly in the blue side of the line. You see some periodicity that appears to be modulated with the stellar rotation. When you look at other lines, like in the H beta line, the inverse P Cygni profiles become more obvious, and you see some periodicity there as diagnosed down here. And one thing that was kind of interesting about this object is that the outflow and the inflow signatures, the P Cygni profiles in the H alpha line and the inverse P Cygni profiles in the H beta line appear to be anti-correlated. So you get stronger outflow with weaker inflow. You can make a cartoon that seems to explain this well if you have a tilted dipole that's interacting with the disk. But we do see some of those interesting behaviors. Now, some of this variability has been modeled. We were looking at this plot from Catherine's talk, or we were looking at this plot from Catherine's talk. And this is one of their models, what they call accretion in the unstable regime. So if the magnetic field is relatively weak or the accretion rate is relatively strong, the accretion kind of pushes in on the magnetosphere, and it can go into what's called an unstable regime. This is the more stable type of accretion, kind of like the PP tau simulation they ran. Then a series of papers, Kurosawa with the lead author has worked on these to develop the ability to calculate line profiles. So in the stable regime, here's a calculation of, I think this is one of the Paschen lines, Paschen beta line. But you see, depending on what phase you're looking at, you see the inverse P Cygni profile get stronger, weaker. But it should be very, very strongly rotationally modulated. And actually, the same thing is generally true for this, this unstable regime. The line profiles get more complicated, but you still see the formation of these inverse P Cygni profiles and other components in the line. Getting back to a question that I think Jim asked, though, you know, can you observationally distinguish this, something like this? And the one thing that I can say is if things were such that the material was just coming in sort of randomly as fingers and impacting the star, you would expect to see fairly rapid changes, I think, in the polarization of that helium line, depending on what field it happened to lock onto right before it hit the stellar surface. We generally don't see that. So at some appreciable distance, the accreting material does seem to, however, grab onto one of the larger scale magnetic field lines and follow it down to the surface of the star. So now we do observe variability in some of these objects. AA tau is one of the more famous ones where you see a redshifted inverse P Cygni component appearing at a particular time through its rotational cycle that coincides with what is believed to be a warp in the disk or something. So you seem to be looking down the funnel flow in that case. But I would say one of the hallmarks, particularly of the line profile type variations that people have studied, is a distinct lack of periodicity. There's a few, two, three stars that show pretty obvious periodicity, but most of them really don't show any obvious periodicity in their spectral line profiles. And the very rapidly accreting stars from their photometric studies, I would argue, don't show any strong periodicity, particularly that you would identify with a rotation period. So there is something unstable about the process, I think, that's happening that is not well captured by our simple models and even some of the more complex simulations that have been done. I'm gonna skip ahead just a little bit. So in terms of sort of general trends, here again from this annual reviews article that Lee led, is showing here is mass accretion rate versus stellar mass, and there does appear to be a correlation, positive correlation. So more massive stars appear to be accreting more rapidly, but a lot of scatter. So it's a general trend, but a lot of scatter. And there appears to be a general fall off with the mass accretion rate with age, with stellar age, going from log of age here, 5 to 7.5. But again, at any one age, a lot of scatter. Well, in this area, there is this general notion of disk locking. It was sort of first brought to attention by Susan Edwards and collaborator in 1994, and what they noticed was if you look at the rotation period of stars and an indication of whether or not they have an infrared excess, an indication of whether or not they have a disk, the ones with disk appear to be all more or less rotating at the same relatively slow period, but the ones without disk were rotating at a variety of periods. And this has been seen with some degree of certainty, though there is a lot of argument, in photometric studies of rotation periods in the Orion Nebular Cluster, in NGC 2264. And the idea is that the magnetic field coupling to the disk at this near this co-rotation radius, after some amount of time, the system comes into an equilibrium such that the star is forced to rotate with the Keplerian velocity of the inner edge of this disk. If that is true, and a number of people have investigated this in an analytic or semi-analytic way, you can write down a prediction for what the stellar magnetic field strength would have to be as a function of things like the stellar mass, the mass accretion rate, the stellar radius, and the rotation period. Everybody has their little fudge factors that relate to just how well the material couples to the disk. But the one thing that is true, that if you go out and look at a sample of stars where we think we know the mass, the accretion rate, the radius, and rotation period, and you plug those into these formulas, you can argue about the exact field strength, but everybody pretty much predicts the same relationship. If one model predicts a strong magnetic field, another model predicts a strong magnetic field. If one model predicts a weak magnetic field, then another model predicts a weak magnetic field. So you could maybe hope to test these models by going out and measuring the magnetic field strength from star to star. And we've tried to do that relying mainly on infrared spectral lines, which, because the Zeeman effect is wavelength sensitive, the infrared lines are far more sensitive than the optical lines are. And here are four titanium lines in the near infrared and the K-band that are very magnetically sensitive. There's also a few CO lines that we've observed that are magnetically insensitive. And you can see that the titanium lines are much broader than the CO lines, and they're much broader than a zero magnetic field model. We actually wind up fitting this data with a distribution of magnetic field strengths on the surface, so we're actually fitting for the filling factor of different field strengths. And so this particular star, TW Haia, we've seen that a lot. We get an average field of 2.6 kilogauss on the surface of the star, so average over the surface. So you can then ask, well, do you see any correlation with predicted field and measured field? And the answer is no. You can add many more stars from different regions to that, and the answer still is no. Maybe we're just wrong, or maybe something else is going on here, and so we'll go on the theory that maybe something else is going on and we're not completely wrong. And perhaps that something else is, you know, the models in general, what they're really telling you is something about the field strength where it's interacting with the disk. And then you have to assume some kind of magnetic geometry to then translate that back down to a field strength on the star. So if instead we if we go by something like this, now there is some scatter, but most of the stars, and when you add the studies from those others, add the results from those other studies, most of the stars have a roughly similar magnetic field at around the 2 to 3, 2.5 kilogauss region. So if you just assume that the magnetic field on every young star is the same, you can then drop the magnetic field and write down a relationship between stellar mass, radius, accretion rate, and rotation period. And they give very similar functional dependencies. One thing that is a little bit unique about the model of Shu and collaborators, as detailed by Eve Ostreicher and Frank Shu, is that what they really care about is the trapped flux in this truncation region, not the field strength, but the flux. And the flux works turns out to be proportional to the stellar mass, the mass accretion rate, and the rotation period. And so if you just assume that the flux is conserved, so that maps somehow onto the star through some geometry, you can write a relationship for the mass flux compared to these other stellar parameters. And so what you're showing here is the filling factor of accretion zones. So you get some prediction if you can measure not only the accretion rate, but the filling factor of accretion zones. And as Catherine was talking about, you can do that when you measure some of these low resolution spectra that are giving you the ultraviolet and the blue wavelength measurements. One thing that you get out is the actual filling factor. And so we took a sample of stars from the literature and looked at the prediction where you have just sort of this general dipole relationship that people have worked out. And it's really a scatter plot. If, on the other hand, you use this trapped flux model, you find that there is a general correlation that shows up in the data. So it does seem, it certainly seems to work better than the pure dipole model. Now, this was for a handful of T Tauri stars that were just taken from the literature. So we decided to try and test this a little bit more on a little bit larger sample of stars by going to NGC 2264, because this is one of the clusters that people had focused on from ground-based photometric studies to get periods. So there were just a lot of stars with periods there. We went out and got the same type of data that you've now seen several times and fit accretion slab models to them, fitting for the accretion rate and for the filling factor of the accretion zones. And when we do the same sort of thing, again, the predictions you get from a pure dipole geometry wind up being a scatter plot, and the predictions that you get from this trapped flux model seem to at least show a correlation where previously you didn't see a correlation. So going back to the accretion onto the star, T Tauri stars aren't the only young stellar objects that are accreting. There are the Herbig AEB stars, a little bit higher mass stars. Whereas pretty much every T Tauri star that we look at shows we can measure the magnetic field. We clearly see observational evidence for strong stellar fields on them. There's Greg Wade and his collaborators have done a lot of work trying to look for magnetic fields on the Herbig AEB stars. And the kind of the long and the short of it is very few of them have detectable fields. Only 5% of them have detectable fields. And so maybe the fields are just weaker. And if they're weaker, maybe they're just smaller. Is there any evidence for that in their accretion properties? And so we looked at this helium 10830 line that I mentioned before. A lot of them show these inverse P Cygni components. And it was known from the work of Susan Edwards and collaborators that when you look at T Tauri stars and you measure the velocity of this redshifted inverse P Cygni component and compare it to the escape velocity for the star, you get a fairly decent correlation. And when we do the same thing for the Herbig AEB stars, I don't know about a correlation, but they certainly seem to generally be weaker than the prediction. And so the suggestion is that if they have magnetospheres, they are in fact smaller because the star has a much smaller magnetic field. And so you are accreting from a much closer in region. And so the infall velocities get to be a smaller fraction of the escape velocity or the free fall velocity. So I will skip, because I'm out of time, and if it comes up in questions, to my summary. And thank you, and take any questions.
When you see these spectra from the surface of the star, do you have a feeling for what density of plasma or gas you're looking at that point?
If I can remember the numbers correctly, they're in the neighborhood of, from the foot points, I think the density is more in the neighborhood of 10 to the 13 or so, 10 to the 14, somewhere in that neighborhood.
So do you worry about stark broadening of the hydrogen at that point?
So the hydrogen, that's coming from the much broader accretion flow. So the density is a little bit lower, but in fact, in the models that James produced, right, they do include stark broadening. And that is needed to give you the sort of broader, smoother wings right at the edge of the Balmer lines. When they ran the models before without stark broadening, they cut off very sharply. So the stark broadening seems to be an important component in reproducing some of the
things. Okay, so you could use that as a density diagnostic then?
I think it would be tough just because there's so many things that...
Well, the stark broadening depends on density.
I understand, but you have to know the actual flow structure and velocity, and the dipole models are generally good, but the actual flow in the end I don't think is a dipole. So I think it would be tough. We could look into it, and to my knowledge, nobody's actually used it as a density measurement, but we could try.
Yeah, there must be a lower limit to what you need to see anything.
We have to have at least a minimum density. But we haven't done that.
Daniel Proger has a question.
The strong magnetic field at the very center must be a distractor. So do we know anything about the mass accretion rate as a function of radius? So do we see a continuous accretion from the outer part through the disk onto the star, or do we see accumulation near the magnetosphere and then sudden deposition of the matter on the surface?
Right.
You mentioned some sort of chaotic behavior that is to destroy any periodicity related to the rotation of the star.
So I think, generally, I think, yes, there is this chaotic behavior. Is that chaotic behavior driven primarily by things happening in the disk as it loads onto the star, as it loads on the field? Or is it a reorganization of the magnetosphere? I think the magnetospheres stay more or less the same for 2, 3, 4 rotation periods, and then somebody mentioned reconnection. I think that happens and it reorganizes a little bit. So the difficulty in finding clear rotational modulation in some of these things is that the disk changing, or is that the magnetosphere changing? I don't think we have a really good answer for that.
Thank you.
Chris Stone.
So going back to the earlier discussion about density diagnostics, it looked like your Balmer jump was always in the wrong place. Was that just a by eye? And
It's because the high Balmer lines pile up.
Yeah.
And so they're just merging in these relatively low resolution spectra. So
was it really that they were just merging, or was there a density effect there as well?
I think it's really that they're just merging. We and others have made models convolve to this spectral resolution, and they just merge. Yeah.
If nobody else has a question, I'm interested in the material that you skipped over on dynamos.
Okay. Well.
Clever, Chris.
So There's also the FU Orionis fields, if you want to talk about that. Yeah, well. So, as also was mentioned earlier, you know, the star formation process drags in, potentially drags in a lot of magnetic flux. And in fact, there's a problem maybe getting rid of enough magnetic flux. And so one thing that we know is that the magnetic fields on these stars are very strong. The photosphere is magnetically dominated. But then the question you can ask is, well, what is the origin of the fields? Is there a true dynamo happening in the star, or is it primarily leftover field as you come from the star formation process? Well, so a couple of clues to that. One is that if it's primarily entrained field from the star formation process, you probably don't expect dramatic changes in the magnetic field and in the magnetic field geometry. Well, we've seen that a couple of times. So here's GQ Loopy. Observed at two different epochs. So this is the photospheric field, and what you can see is the field was modulated with the rotation pretty strongly, and it reached peak field strengths of about 450 to 500 Gauss on the star. And at a later time, it was much weaker. It was 100 Gauss or something like that. And so, and this is again over the whole star. We've analyzed a lot of data on TW Haia, which again is seen nearly pole on. In 2013, we saw a fairly dramatic change in the magnetic field, strengthening the magnetic field, just from the measurements. So that, I think, would, people have used that to argue for the true dynamo happening. One thing that I have gotten a little bit interested in is okay, why is the dynamo so strong, apparently so strong in these young stars? Well, they're relatively rapidly rotating and they have very deep convection zones, perhaps some of them fully convective. And so some dynamo models suggest that that should be very, very efficient at producing magnetic field. I will say that when we look at the magnetic field properties on these young stars, they don't correlate with rotation, they don't correlate with convective turnover time, they don't correlate with any regular dynamo number that you can come up with. The RSCVN stars, though, are also rapidly rotating stars with deep convection zones. So we've started to go out and measure, try to measure magnetic fields on some of these stars. And so this is very new data. I haven't done the whole sample. We do see, we can actually measure them. Here's one such star, HD 113816. And so we do see a field there, but an average field strength of a kilogauss or less, not in the 2.5 to 3 kilogauss level. Now, this is only one star. A handful of our T-Tauri stars were at that low level, but we'll be doing this for a lot more stars and hopefully provide some constraints for dynamo, stellar dynamo theorists. So.
Could you produce variations in the apparent magnetic field by changing which field lines are loaded with emitting gas?
So these field measurements, you're measuring photospheric absorption lines. The accreting material covers, you know, a percent or two or three of the star. So that makes no effect on these measurements. The helium polarization measurements, absolutely. If you change the field lines you're loading, you could in principle change that. And that's why I was saying if the material was actually penetrating deep into the magnetosphere before it finally hit the star, you would expect to see fairly rapid changes in polarity in that helium line. And we generally do not see that. It appears to be modulated more or less on a rotational time scale, indicating that that material is loading far from the star.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Paula?
So I was wondering if you have the information that you can correlate together the light curves of, say, the X-ray, the UV, and the optical. I mean, you showed a Doppler map of the, that was the optical, right?
Right.
And So is there a way, I mean, because I work on the ones that are accreting onto white dwarfs, and there we have very clear modulations that are much more apparent in the higher energies, and it tells us the sizes of the accretion areas. Can you get out, do you have the data to look at the sizes respective of the different wavelengths?
So the short answer is no. When we go to things like the ultraviolet HST spectra, typically we just don't have that much coverage, particularly over the course of a rotation or something like that, in order to sort of back out the filling factors in these regions. So it's hard.
You'd only need like half of the orbit, right? Half of the rotation. So that's like a 6 hours or so, or? I mean, you could do time tag mode.
No, it's still several days. For most of the, we're talking typical rotation periods of a week.
Oh, okay.
Right, so getting that much HST time, I'd love it, but it's a little hard.
Any last questions or comments for Chris? Okay, James?
When the shock is plowing into the star, what happens to the star? Because, I mean, it's plowing into the star.
It's plowing inside.
The outer envelope is going to be affected.
Outer
envelope is going to be affected to the star, so what happens to the rest of the star?
Well, so I think it's a little bit unclear. There is a problem, potential problem. Some of the initial calculations of where these accretion shocks should stop suggested that they should be deep down in the star. And so then you have to wonder, well, why do we still see them? So I think it's not, it's a little bit unclear. One thing I didn't show, though, there have been, within the past few years, some numerical studies of variable flows, and they seem to have, when they put that in, that shock front moves up and down fairly dramatically. So that could produce some rapid timescale variation that we haven't really probed in ultraviolet and X-ray type wavelengths yet.
This is only about a percent of the stellar surface.
Yeah, so in terms of stellar structure, it's probably not changing much at all. Right.
Before we wrap up, are there any announcements from the conference organizers? If not,
I think they're here.
So. Right there.
Enjoy dinner. Okay, let's thank all the speakers this afternoon.